You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Wu, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Seth Partno of StatsBomb and of The Athletic. And as you could expect, based on the timing, we are talking about the NBA trade deadline. And a lot of interesting takeaways here about the moves that did and didn't happen, and who are some of our winners and some of our losers are, and how it sets up the 2024 offseason is also a really important thread of this. So really enjoyed the conversation with Seth. It's brought to you by FanDuel. FanDuel.com/Boston. New customers get $200 in bonus bets if your first bet of $5 or more wins. Episode is a little bit less than an hour. Lots of great stuff in here. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Daniel, good to speak with you.
The trade deadline just passed. We're recording this on Friday. And I wanted to start with kind of, do you have any big picture takeaways from what did and didn't happen?
This is not an original thought by me. I actually saw a friend of mine put this on Twitter, X, but we're still going to call it Twitter, the other day, and was noting that it seems like the last 2 years, even sort of the big in-season trades happened early. And I think we saw a little bit the same thing this year with Harden and Anobi and Siakam all getting traded, you know, decently far in advance of the deadline. And I think that meant the trade deadline was active, but with the possible exception of what the Knicks did, not of massive import on this year's title chase. I think there were a couple teams that made some, you know, smart around the margins moves, but it wasn't, you know, there was not a I don't know. The level of Woj bomb we got was not as high as it has been some years, put that way.
I mean, one way to describe that is the furthest my jaw dropped was Spencer Dinwiddie getting waived, not any of the trades that actually happened. So that's an indicator of where things are. And I think that a big part of the story is the context that led us down this path. And that context will change in time. But you have a couple of different big forces that I think are worth mentioning and first, in some cases, worth discussing. So one of them is the most needy team seems a little bit strong because OKC wouldn't fit this. But a lot of teams at the top that could benefit from upgrades just not having the resources to do it. And that's a mix of them owing a ton of picks. That's a mix of them not having the financial flexibility in terms of matching salary. And in many cases, it's the limitations of the second apron.
Yeah, I spent some time yesterday trying to figure out the degree of encumbrances on future draft picks. And at any given time, there's 210 picks that are possibly out there for either exchange or swap. And that number, you know, actually might drop, like the number that are available for outright trade might be significantly lower than that for Stepien rule reasons. And I didn't get very far with trying to calculate how many there were because some of them have been passed around so many times. But I think it's significant. And we've, you know, as we've seen over the last 3, 4, 5 years, sort of since the end of the Warriors hegemony, that, you know, teams have been very aggressive in trading lots of future draft assets, and the teams that have done so are largely still the team, like you mentioned OKC as one exception, but they're largely the teams that should have been quote unquote buyers at the deadline this year. So they already bought. Their shopping was largely done. So you had teams like, you know, the Bucks trying to scrounge around with what can we get with some middling second or a couple middling seconds and, you know, a middling prospect like Marjon Beauchamp and some salary. It's not really a lot to offer. And so that's one bit of it. And there are other aspects I'm sure you're going to get to. I think that, unfortunately, I think there were a couple places where some of the more interesting possible players were encumbered by sort of internal dysfunction.
Sure.
And I think we can certainly Chicago, them standing pat was just silly. And I think we all have suggestions that I don't think that would have been Arturas Karnisovas's first choice to sit everything out rather than sort of restart. And then Atlanta sort of not really understanding where they are. And then I might even throw Detroit in there a touch. But I mean, we'll get to them.
Yeah, we'll get to Detroit. And I think that the factor that also connects with this, and it made the 24 deadline a little bit different, is the idea that a lot of the potential traded players are under contract for next year. And how that changes things when you think about that in terms of, we brought up the encumbrances that other teams have, is those two things speak together in the case of, let's say, DeJounte Murray, where if the Lakers were, you know, if it was more like one first and maybe a swap, we don't know the exact, and it seems like the Lakers were valuing their own players and everything else, and whether Atlanta was holding too firm to the idea of it has to be expiring salary instead of the idea that you can trade somebody like D'Angelo Russell, like there are levels of contract badness and everything else. And so there were reasons for numerous teams, the Wizards with Kuzma is another example, the Blazers with Jeremy Grant, to say, okay, here are the offers that are on the table. We're considering those. And I think in some cases, at least based on the public pronouncements, there may have been a little too little shopping. That could potentially be the case. But there was a realistic and pragmatic assessment to say, and I think DeJounte Murray is the easiest way to say this, where we could trade him potentially for more in the summer, even though the teams that we're negotiating with, like usually the idea is you get more early, like with, you know, OG Anunoby and Pascal Siakam, that I thought the Raptors held too long, because the teams get them for longer. And so there's more value there for the potential trade partners to have them for an extra postseason and an extra start of the season conceptually. But if the teams that are interested can, let's say in the case of like the Mavericks for certain guys and the Lakers for some guys, they can only trade one first now, and unless you burn those first, you can trade three in a couple of months. Well, then you might not get three, but you might get two.
I think the other side of that to look is, I mean, the balance between when to trade and when not, and sometimes where it's just like, okay, well, that's the best we're going to get. It's not quite the same thing, but I think the way I thought you were going with this, with the players under contract, is sort of the outgoing salary
sure.
under contract. And I think that one of the moves that low-key did not make a ton of sense to me was for Charlotte, the Gordon Haywood trade. I think for a team in their situation, I could easily argue they got negative value for Hayward's expiring contract. Like, they didn't between the you know, the money that's owed to Bertans next year and Micic, is he an NBA player? Is he an NBA player worth paying that amount for a team in Charlotte's situation? Is that enough to balance out what potential there might still be in Trey Mann? I didn't love that. And so there are situations where, like, letting a guy walk for nothing is not actually the worst thing that can happen.
For sure. And there's also, and even if you lose that, the leverage, like, there is something, and Charlotte's notable for this. Miles Bridges' situation is different for myriad reasons. But there's also the possibility that you could sign and trade that player, depending on the structure. You could get something on the back end. And for Charlotte, it's been a big criticism of mine for various teams over the last couple of years, where they got paid a pretty weak premium for how much money they saved the the Thunder. And it's so funny because I've criticized the Thunder for that a lot over the years. The Thunder and then the Wizards in the Marvin Bagley trade, which was before the like deadline day, but was still within the kind of like window, where they got a pretty weak return for saving the Pistons $12 million for next year on a player who's definitely not worth that. And, you know, his place on a good or a bad team is somewhat in question. And so from Charlotte's perspective, there is also like the fascinating part of shifting, let's call it $20 million. It's probably a little bit less than that. It's probably more like 18 from OKC to Charlotte for next year is OKC functionally went from being acting like an over the cap team, which they still could do, to being a cap space team. And Charlotte now, they could still wield cap space depending on what happens with Bridges, but like they might function as an over the cap team. So it's not even a circumstance of like why I brought up the Wizards with Bagley, where, oh, it doesn't make that much of a difference to us. It really helps you, but it doesn't make things that much worse for us. And sometimes those situations you get a lower return just because the delta for you isn't that big. But for Charlotte, like I liked a lot of the other things they did. It was weird.
I mean, yeah, it's weird because like you're talking about that trade primarily as financial. I mean, as crafty a cap sheet operator as Sam Presti's been, I sort of think that the more impactful bit now that they are, you know, one of the teams that I think that they are certainly a conference finalist contender. I mean, sure. We may, given their lack of playoff experience, especially in the case of Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, the lack of playoff experience as a number one guy, you know, they might be a long shot for real postseason success this year. But I think Hayward is a guy who, if healthy, really potentially helps them quite a lot. And they, like I said, they traded basically nothing from their current rotation and bad money. So again, give or take your prognostication on Trey Mann going into the last year of his rookie deal.
There's also, you brought up Misich, the idea that, like, I think having competent backup point guard play for Charlotte is valuable, but did it have to be him, or could you have gotten somebody else? I mean, I don't know who the next Raul Neto is, but, like, you know, get one of the more talented minimum guys, or in the case of Charlotte, maybe pay a little bit extra. They have cap space. They also have the room exception for next year if they're going that route. And so I think having a player who can fill that role is useful. Not having it was a big problem for them this year, but I mean, that is something different.
That's maybe this is getting into some other teams, but it's hard for me to think that addressing the backup point guard position for a team that has only won 10 games because they've low key been one of the most overperforming clutch teams this season. A stat I've been tracking is they have not won a single game that did not reach the clutch this year. They're, I believe, entering tonight's game against Milwaukee, they're 0-26 in games that have never been in clutch situation. They haven't won a game by more than 7 points. All of which, and they have the 30th net rating in the league and so on and so forth. All of which seems to say, like, making a move to shore up your backup point guard position, sort of like making a move to get a reasonably okay swing forward shooter for a 32nd or 31st pick if you're on track to win under 20 games. Like,
I was gonna say it's kind of like getting a nice backyard set when you have a severe like mudslide or landslide risk, where it's like, yeah, it might be nice to have, but it might not matter for long.
Yeah, and that's all. That's in contrast to me with I thought that they did very well in the other trade they made with Grant Williams, who I think is a pretty good candidate to rehab some value, given that he's been a pretty good player over his career. And there's the obvious, like, had off-season surgery and was never in shape and this season. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, that's the thing that we've seen resolve itself, as well as a potentially very good first round pick, given the timing for PJ Washington, a player for whom the idea has always been a little bit better than the reality.
I wanted to ask you about that. It was something I dwelled on with Nate when we recorded after the deadline of that PJ Washington, to me, there was this idea years ago that oh, you know, he's a talented offensive player. He's a good shooter. If he could ever defend the five. And what has happened since then is we got a lot more information that he can't defend the five, at least with the ecosystem with Charlotte. I would be, you know, maybe if you had a lot better defenders around him, you could do things differently. And then he's also been a worse shooter the last couple of years. And so for me, it's weird to have a young player, like a player this young, be somebody who's past is overrating their present, but I think it's true with him.
I think that's right, though. I mean, you balance that by, and this is something that I sort of have applied to Hayward too. There's a little bit of like of sort of Boris Diaw potential, whether it's just being in a better ecosystem or playing in real games again, or both. That, you know, maybe we see something different just from a. I don't want to say a motivation, but just from a, you know, ready, focused, do the right things and good things will happen. I don't think there's a lot of returns right now for, you know, a third, fourth, fifth option type in Charlotte. Like, there's not a lot of play the right way return.
Well, it's the it's I mean, right, you think back to, wasn't there that stretch where it was like just get some of the players who were like lower on the Kings? This is when the Kings were bad, and like they may end up working out for you. Like, just buy low on all of them and just see if any of them can hit. There have been, and Charlotte has incidentally been one of those teams over the years. And with Washington, like I brought up that he's been shooting worse the last couple of years. He is going to get the cleanest 3-point looks of his career over the next 6 months. And we will get a much more open understanding of, well, how does he work in that sort of a circumstance? Because, I mean, we saw it with Grant Williams, and who'd been a reasonable offensive circumstance with Boston. But like playing with Luka, playing with Kyrie, if you're a front court player who can shoot, you will get those opportunities.
And Grant has shot the ball okay this year. I think it's been his defense that's been more the problem. And again, for a guy who is sort of undersized and tends towards the thicker side, like being, you know, not really ever being in shape this season, I think was pretty much went a long way towards torpedoing that move. And it's funny because like there's been stuff kicked around. Oh, they got off of that awful Grant Williams contract, and you look at it, and it's like, well, he's making like mid-level, maybe slightly below money for the next couple of years, and it's like, you know, it's not gonna take that much kind of return to form for that to look much better.
Especially if you put him in a scheme where his, you know, what it seemed like part of what happened with Dallas was there was an incongruity between what they wanted their capable defenders in the front court to do and what Grant Williams is good at, whereas Derek Jones Jr. was a much more natural fit.
Yeah, I mean, what they're actually trying to do defensively is, you know.
Oh, I mean, Seth, do you want to talk about Jason Kidd's coaching and philosophy?
I do not.
So let's go to Detroit. It came up a little bit earlier. They traded. I mean, it felt like at one point they had 50 guys on their roster. They eventually waived enough guys to make everything work logistically.
Weaver the waiver.
Yes. And so the biggest move that they made was the one with the Knicks, where they traded Bogdanović and Alec Burks to the Knicks for Quentin Grimes, the young player return. They got some seconds, and then they got more, I would say, in the realm of salary filler with Malachi Flynn, Archie Diakono, and Evan Fournier. That's one element of what they did. But then they also brought in Simone Fontecchio for a legit second-round pick. How are you feeling about their overall deadline performance?
Yeah, it's bad. I say this as someone who has liked Quentin Grimes, and when that trade, I mean, it's funny because that trade had to be for cap reasons, had to be technically two separate trades. Mm-hmm. That it first sort of came out that it was like Grimes and a pick for Burks. So I was like, hey, I like that. And then it's like, oh, and the other half is Bojan Bogdanović for nothing. And it's, I mean, for the team that probably has the worst combination of talent and asset base in the league, or is there or thereabouts, the fact that they managed to come out of the deadline, I think, not necessarily worse, but not improved on either front, is staggering to me.
I'm intrigued by what Fontecchio could do for them. I've been very into the way that he's helped the Jazz just by having competence at the three, and that could be good for the Pistons, but they have so many other problems that how much will it really change things? And
this is an argument that people, like, I kind of lost my mind a little bit about this trade in particular, just because it's just like, this is a classic example of situational value, in that if the Phoenix Suns had made this exact same trade, I would love it. Or if the Phoenix Suns or, you know, the Lakers or the Bucks or, you know, pick a team that is kind of, you know, even the Nuggets, like, I would be, I was like, yes, that is the kind of trade. But it just shows such a complete, is ignorance the right word? Lack of understanding of where you are. And then the fact that you're saying that, oh, well, they needed a solid environment around which to judge, you know, all of their young players. This is a guy who's 28-year-old. He's second year in the league. He's played 90 NBA games. And that's going to be your context setter as you're, you know, a guy who's a reasonably competent swing forward who's probably more of a four than a three, if we're being honest. That's the guy who you think is going to provide this context for you to judge, you know, and it might improve the context you're working with, which begs the question of what did you put together in the first place?
Yeah. Well, and that was to me the biggest thing, and I harped on this in various places, including in a Dunktown Prime mailbag or Discord chat, where I think Troy Weaver had a reasonable deadline, better than I expected, when you consider the moral hazard involved.
But go ahead.
Yeah, but he still shouldn't have been doing it, and he should still not be running the Detroit Pistons after this. And the risk of somebody like that, who built something so disastrous, getting more opportunities to make decisions for you, is just something that you can't abide by.
I mean, I think that our friend at The Athletic, James Edwards, reported that they had something on the table for Isaiah Stewart, didn't they?
I believe he did.
Maybe I'm confusing someone offering a trade for, like, as sort of all of my pet peeves, but them having an offer on the table for Killian Hayes before the season and Monty Williams shutting that one down, which, you know, it's hard to disentangle. The whole thing is just a mess there. And also, like, to some degree, this goes against my usual tactic of, I would like to judge moves in and of themselves, but it's sort of hard in a situation where, like, the best thing you can say for some of these moves is increasing the optionality for a group that I think has consistently picked poor or worse options. So it's almost a negative.
I mean, you hope that you're creating those options for someone else. But, like, one thing that I feel a little bit better about with the Pistons is, I don't know exactly how the alchemy is going to work with Grimes, Cade Cunningham, and Jaden Ivey. Not saying those three have to play together as a three-man unit all the time, but at least, like, you get a little bit of a different look. They have somebody who can do point of attack, who's lower usage, who can hit some threes. And Grimes fell out of the rotation in the Knicks, and at first I was a little bit outraged, but Dante DiVincenzo outplayed him and was better for what the Knicks needed specifically.
I mean, he's been hurt and didn't go to Villanova, so, you know.
Sure, that's a concern as well. And so, yeah. I think that there is a chance that Grimes will work out, and I think that they need more rolls of those kinds of dice than the Kevin Knoxes, the James Wisemans of the world, which have been such a staple of the Troy Weaver regime, is like second draft guys who just straight up sucked after their first draft. And there may be context, like, I mean, and with Wiseman, it was like, also, they gave up Sadiq Bey in that deal. Not that he's had a great year by any stretch of the imagination. But yeah, I mean, the Pistons are a disaster. The people who made it a disaster ideally would no longer be making those decisions. But alas, and where I think plenty more to discuss. But first, a message from FanDuel. Happy Super Bowl to all who celebrate from FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. If you're like me, Super Bowl Sunday is all about scoring the best seat on the couch, grabbing your favorite football snacks, and placing some super bets. Especially for me, as someone who grew up in the Bay Area, who is a 49ers fan, I'm extremely excited about that. And of course, there are a lot of great player props. And I don't know if I'm more optimistic or realistic, but I'd love for the Niners to do well. And of course, there's always the fun. You can bet on the length of the national anthem and all sorts of other great stuff. FanDuel has so many ways for you to end the season with a W, or two, or three. Not only can you bet on who will win Super Bowl 58, but FanDuel also has bets for which players will score a touchdown, how many points will be scored, and so much more. New customers join today and you'll get $200 in bonus bets if your first bet of $5 or more wins. Just visit FanDuel.com/Boston to sign up. That's FanDuel.com/Boston. Make every moment more with FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or over and present in select states. FanDuel is offering sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as a non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit fanduel.com/RG in Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 533-42 in Arizona, 1-888-789-777 or ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700 or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana, visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York. To go to basically the opposite end of that continuum, the Thunder brought in Gordon Hayward, mm-hmm. and they theoretically have cap space. I don't know if they're going to use that to actually spend it. They could stay over. There are a lot of things they could do. But it did bring attention to just the unusual circumstance that they are in, where they are not only one of the youngest teams in the league, they are one of the best teams in the league, and they have a significant amount of team control on their most important players moving forward. The question I have for you is, how do you navigate this next step where they have a ton of resources, though they don't have a ton of truly premium ones if they're keeping, you know, their best young players and if they're keep, because they don't have, like, I mean, it doesn't look like that Houston pick that they got, which is top four protected, is going to be like six or something like that. Do you identify a need and go after a player, maybe you even like overpay to get the perfect player for that, sort of like the Bucks did with Jrue Holiday? Or do you see how things play out? Do you just bet on talent and just hope that you can shake out like the, you know, the niches and the archetypes?
So I like what they did with Hayward, in that I wish they had found their way to do something like the Celtics did for Xavier Tillman.
Sure.
I don't think I would be in huge support of them making a huge splash, big move, just because I do think you need to see what this team that with their current approach looks like in a postseason run. And that's everything from what does Shea look like as a number one guy? Where is Chet relative to that? How does sort of the mid ball with this group, you know, with the multiple Williams they have and Gilgeous Alexander and how well does Josh Giddey fit in with that? Does he continue to fit in with that? I do think I would want that bit of information. And it's unfortunate. This is maybe a criticism you could have lobbed back. And my podcast partner, Mo Dakhil, has brought this up. Like, they might have been better. They probably would be in a better situation vis-a-vis this year's playoffs had they made the playoffs last year, just so they could have gotten that look at Shea. But at the same time, I'm not going to, like, bang on them for not, like, coming into the season and not saying, yes, Chet Holmgren is going to be an all-star and we will, and he still would say, he's going to be an all-star.
An all-star caliber impact. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, an all-star caliber impact. Like, you know, you may have been 60% sure of that coming into the season. You're 90% sure of that now. And I think that difference is material. And so moves that they might have made had they had the same level of knowledge this year. Like, I don't think it's fair to say they should have done that. So I think that, like, not going out and making a big splash, like, we're going to trade a crap ton of draft picks. You know, we're going to trade everything that isn't nailed down for Mikal Bridges or something like that. As tasty as that team would be, you also kind of need to know that, you know, that your number one and two guys are at or reasonably soon be at the level of being playoff number ones and twos to make that sort of expenditure of capital worth it. I do wish they had put some more clubs in the bag for playing different ways, and in particular, just getting a big body, like a competent big body, because yeah. I think that they're just going to, if it's, you know, I think they go in against I think they're drawing close to dead against a healthy Denver team in the playoffs.
I'm definitely concerned. And I think that on that front, I'm not concerned about the Thunder or basically any other front. And the general conceit of what you said, I think, is really on point, where they have a lot of resources, but they also need to learn a lot about what they're doing, because it's extremely rare. Like, I mean, we talked about how rare it is for like a just put together team to compete. Well, it's even more rare for a young team to compete at a high level. Usually it's the crawl, walk, run idea, and the Thunder are better than the average young team, but playoff experience matters. I mean, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has played 450 playoff minutes, and the most recent of those occurred in, I believe, was April of 2020. So it's been a while. And he wasn't this guy then, obviously. He actually had a pretty rough series in that playoff series. And the Thunder, it's even more important because they run things a little bit unconventionally. And so we may not get this in a small sample. Hopefully they make it far enough in the playoffs where this becomes relevant. But we kind of need to see if the theory of the case works, because how does a series of like drives and passes out, playing the four, spacing at the five, how does that work with playoff officiating? How do these players work with like the shifts in coaching and in personnel and taking away more transition? Because the Thunder have been good in those respects. Does it work as well as it has in the regular season? Is it the common degradation, or is it something more extreme for them? Because if it's more extreme for them, that's something they may have to address with some of their resources.
No, I think that's right. I think that's the right way of putting it. And it's you know, as you say, like in the last, I don't know however long you want to put it, like the really young, inexperienced teams that have run to the finals are the first Warriors title team and the Suns team that made the finals. And I think fair to say, A, caught some breaks and also added Chris Paul.
Sure.
You know, so those are the two examples. It's like an all-time great team and, you know, a team that I think was a slightly unique amalgamation of kind of up and coming talent and playoff experience. So, sure. And so, yeah, just seeing if, you know, in particular, seeing if you know, Shai in particular has the versatility as a scorer, as a creator, to, you know, see the third, fourth, fifth wrinkle that gets thrown at him and have him still be able to perform. We don't know, like, my guess is it'll probably work, but you don't know until you know. And again, I wouldn't want to start throwing, you know, as many picks as they have, I wouldn't start like wanting to start throwing 4, 5, 6 of them around before I knew that. And also, like, frankly, I don't even, like, before I knew what I needed to complement whatever the weaknesses turn out to be in this postseason.
Especially with the fluidity of some of their defensive positional stuff. Like, I've been thinking about this, that, like, if I were running the Thunder right now, one of the elements that I would be at least considering, depending on Degnault and everything else, is you don't bring in, like, a high level player to fill one of their things, you get a couple of different bites of the apple. So like one of the theories I had is like a point of attack defender, a bigger wing, you know, who can defend the Kawhis of the world and all that type of stuff. That could be Lu Dort, but maybe you want eventually a better Lu Dort in those circumstances, kind of like the Grizzlies intended and have not succeeded with replacing Dylan Brooks. But that sort of an idea. And then the other context, so I mean the evaluation is central here, is that the Thunder have a few years before their team gets really expensive, but they only have a few. And so theoretically, whether it's using that $35 million or so in cap space or trading for players or doing whatever, like you can't, unless ownership is totally amenable, you can't just throw everything in, get like I'm using an example, but like Zion Williamson, and then be like, oh, well, we're just set from here on out. Because it's like, well, then is everyone involved pulling the lever to be a high level tax team in 3-4 years? Now, maybe by that point, they've won a title or two, or maybe they're in the mix at that point. But this is the exact issue, though it was different. It was a different situation. That was part of what killed the Thunder with the Harden, Westbrook, Durant years, is that they saw the writing on the wall, were a little bit too preemptive, and in that case, the circumstances changed and it would have been okay. But there's a lot that you need to have on board before you make that kind of a commitment.
That's right.
What other team situations stood out to you? I mean, one that I wanted to ask you about, because you're not as geographically proximate to it, is the Warriors, where they could have done a lot of things. I expected them to do very little. They ended up doing very little.
I just think they're done. I'm sorry. I don't
that's fair.
Maybe that's just I think that honestly their window to do stuff was last year, and I did hear that they had some ideas out there that just kind of ran into the morass of the non-moving teams.
Yeah, I mean, there's reporting from Casey Johnson that they at least talked about Caruso.
I mean, I don't think there's rumors that I don't think we can report on what the deal actually like was, and if the rumors we've heard are true, it seemed like a pretty reasonable idea for both sides. So I think that like the Warriors are just at that stage where, like, as good as Kuminga has been for the last month or so, there's still just the fact that Klay Thompson and Draymond Green, and I think under the radar, but as importantly, Kevon Looney, have just sort of aged out.
And they don't have enough replacements, especially with Wiggins playing poorly as he's done.
And you guys in the Bay are spoiled by, you know, having the full decade of, because the Bucks have had, I was actually having this conversation with Eric Name this morning, is the Bucks have entered the stage of the Roman Empire where they're sort of, you know, with the Pat Beverly trade. I was driving in to have coffee with him, and there's a big welcome Pat Beverly billboard up on Fiserv Forum. And it was sort of like, this is the Roman Empire paying the Goths to turn around from invading the borders to defending the borders stage of a team. And that's sort of what happens after about a team is had 5-6 years as a contention level team, is they get hollowed out and they're sort of, you know, the never ending string of ring chasers, basically. And the Warriors, in large part because of the because of the Durant situation, were able to regenerate themselves the first time, and then somehow pulling all-star level Andrew Wiggins and a draft pick out of adding D'Angelo Russell, like, let them extend it another couple of years. That's unusual. And
it is. And there's a lot of lamentation about like the opportunities that went by, like James Wiseman, you know, having the number two pick in that draft and getting basically nothing for it. But they had a lot of luck, just like they, you know, to build it and to sustain it, just like pretty much any championship team has. I mean, you could even go back, like, I remember when I was working on my book, like I was going through like transaction history stuff, and it was like some of the stuff that we look back on, like the trades that Red Auerbach did, and you're like, how did this exist?
Yeah. I think that really the lamentation is like not either moving or developing Kuminga, but especially Moses Moody more last season. Mm-hmm. And I know I've harped on this, but it is for a player that I still think has some potential to be something, like the way they have just conspired to to really get nothing out of a guy who, you know, has a skill set and position that should have value. Both, it should have been of help to them, but even if they decided he wasn't for whatever reason, like, I think it's fair to say that under Steve Kerr, that it does take a certain kind of feel level of a player to successfully perform in that system, even if they felt he wasn't that. You know, a long wing who can shoot and defend. It's, you know, there's guys who can only do that in theory that got at minimum, you know, multiple decent seconds over the last couple of years. So not even being in a position to do that, and now going into an offseason where they're going to have to make decisions on extensions and stuff like that, is I feel like they're going to rue that situation. And then I think that they're probably, if I'm reading the tea leaves, they're going to probably talk themselves into Kuminga being a whole lot more than what he is. As nice as the last little run has been for him.
It seems almost inevitable. And one of the real hallmarks of the Lakeup era is they have this small market young optimism on their young guys, and then it works out sometimes, it doesn't work out sometimes, and that is a challenge, because it's part of why the two timelines thing was such a weird gambit, is because you
weird
generally
is not the word I'd use, but go on.
It's too hard to be good in one timeline, much less two.
Yeah, yeah.
And so having, you know, and there are always going to be misevaluations in talent and everything like that, and Steph Curry bridges gaps in ways that very few players in history have.
I'll also say there's probably a little bit of high unknown supply from, you know, all right, it was bold and ballsy to, no, Klay Thompson's going to be really good, actually. If you remember, like, I was certainly someone who thought they were crazy for not being willing to include Klay in a trade for Kevin Love.
I think they would have been pretty,
but like the fact that, you know, Klay developed into one of the, you know, in some ways you could describe him as the best 3-and-D player of this era. And I think that's probably selling his offensive game a touch short, but, or even more than that, given, like, you know, the level of explosiveness that he had, that, you know, even if on a game to game basis, he might never average, you know, 28 or something like that. The fact that the odd, you know, 25-point quarter was still around in Key's playoff situations, nice thing to have around. Like, the fact that that worked out the way it did, you almost wonder if it's like, well, we did it once, we'll do it again, though.
Very fair.
Even though it's like, okay, yes, the you got the one black swan, and now you think that in your pond, black swan's just a light?
It's a question that we're presumably going to have a longer time to evaluate, even though Bob Myers isn't there anymore. Joe Lacob's going to still run the Warriors, and we'll see what happens with Kerr. But how this philosophy changes over time as the franchise, like, turns over, will be something worth watching. Last question I wanted to ask you. It's a little bit of a thought experiment. Let's take us back in time to the OG Anunoby trade, I think, was December 30th. So, but we'll say kind of that is the deadline window. So it's a little bit more than a month. What teams, and you can factor on court stuff as well, but you factor in whatever you want, do you think have had the biggest delta in terms of how you feel about the franchise in a positive or a negative way since then?
Franchise?
Like, so how good they are, where they're going, all that type of stuff.
I don't know how you say anything other than that the Knicks are the most improved team from the start of the season till now. I mean, I've been pretty bullish on the decision making in the Leon Rose era of the Knicks to begin with, and I think that's only continued through this deadline.
They were able to get, you know, to get OG Anunoby, and it seems like, even though nothing is ironclad, to have him be able to transform things to the extent, and unfortunately he has this elbow surgery, that's been huge. I mean, the Jalen Brunson identification and acquisition, even if there were some forces that helped that happen, it still did happen, and they valued him more than the Dallas Mavericks did, and they were 100% right, and the Mavericks were 100% wrong. And from the Knicks' perspective, the other thing that I've been wondering about is, like, you brought up the decision making that has been there, and they've done some nice work in terms of asset management as well. Does this sufficiently set the table for a next step, whatever that is, whether that is, you know, bringing in another really good player, like somebody who can step into a larger role offensively, defensively, or both, or is it, you know, some restructuring with the things that you have left. Like, I'm interested to see what these decision makers do from here.
So first of all, like, speaking of decision making, I want to laud them in one area, because I think, you know, we've talked about teams sort of overvaluing their own guys a lot. And I think I like Quentin Grimes. I think Quentin Grimes is a good player. I think the Knicks correctly sort of surmised that, you know, it's the way it's worked out. Like, he is kind of surplus to what we're doing here. We like him right now. I mean, we could, between Josh Hart and Dante DiVincenzo, go Nova. like, there isn't really a path for him to become. So let's turn that into, I think, two very reasonable, you know, playoff rotation pieces in Burks and Bogdanović. And I think Bogdanović is especially important, not just for the postseason, but I think for the next X number of weeks while they're shorthanded in the front court. So I think it works. So they're a team that they can, I mean, they're, what are they tied for third in the East, and they're pretty close to second. They could easily find themselves in the second seed. And this is, you know, you're talking about, like, you know, what do they do next? They might make the finals next. Like, let's not.
It's possible. You mean the conference finals or the NBA finals? I think
the NBA finals. The NBA finals. Like, they, I mean, as of right now, I think they're the second most likely team to come out of the East.
Whew. It's reasonable. I mean, especially with the Joel.
I mean, that's you know, I
there are other contenders, but
there are other contenders.
They played better than everybody. And I mean, the Cavs are a weird. I've used weird way too much in this podcast. The Cavs are an unusual situation.
Yeah. I think that we don't trust the Cavs. I think we're gonna have to. The Cavs are definitely
for some reason.
I think the Cavs have too many. They got to prove it in the playoffs. Important players.
I'll echo you on the Knicks, and I'll do one on the negative end. The Mavericks took on a lot of downside risk, or as I often phrase this, disaster potential, for a very modest upgrade.
A lot of, I mean, I, you know, we, so like the picks that they encumbered going out were a top two 2027, right?
PJ Washington deal.
The PJ Washington trade, right. And 2027 is it, like, if Luka decides to force a trade, like, his contract ends in 27. So it would have been like a year earlier. So maybe that's the year after they've traded him. Also, they did have we seen any reporting on there being any protections on the pick swap they did with OKC in 28?
I haven't seen any specific pronouncements either way, but I believe that, considering all the forces involved, if there were real protection on that pick, it would already be known.
So, and that's the year that after which Luka could have just walked. And that was sort of the price for getting the pick that they used to add Daniel Gafford, who's a player I like fine, but is would you say, wholly duplicative with Derek Lively?
Largely. And having another capable center will really help them, but does that make them, you know, does that win them around in the playoffs? Probably not.
It doesn't put another club in the bag, though,
because
again, it's a you know,
to use a Zelda analogy that I won't do perfectly, like, it makes the weapon more durable. It doesn't give you a new weapon.
Yeah.
But the other wild part of this is that the Mavericks have now negotiated pick swaps with arguably the two franchises that you would least want to have pick swaps with 5 years down the road. The San Antonio Spurs, because they have the most exciting young player in the league, like, super young player in the league right now. And the Oklahoma City Thunder, who have the best young core in the league right now.
And also one of the more astute asset managery GMs, I think. It's sort of like we don't really know how much of this is a narrative forming by the order in which stories come out versus the order in which they actually happened. But certainly the reporting as deadline day went on was they had the Gafford trade worked out, and then, oh, and they're still trying to work out how to get the draft compensation they need to make that trade with the Thunder. And it's like, oh, so you're gonna give away leverage in negotiating draft pick trades with Sam Presti and hope that works out well for you.
It has a poor track record.
Yeah, and you know, maybe that's just a function of it's sort of like the you know, this is something that comes up more, I would say, in free agency every year, where sort of the order in which deals get announced sort of affects our opinion of them, when in actuality, like, not to suggest there's tampering going on in this establishment, but like, it's all been worked out, so it's not like there's a cascading sequence. So having already done that, why is that the next
thing? Mitchell Robinson came out, I believe, after Hartenstein, and you're like, what? And then it was because part of the reason Robinson got so much was because they could keep his low cap hold.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that I mean, and you know, I don't think that this, what they did, is it really needle movie in terms of where they are this year? I mean, I guess we can expect PJ Washington to be better than what Grant Williams has been this year, but are they Grant Williams being good this year from being like good and dangerous?
I don't think so. I think they're further out. And even though the West is murkier than it has been at times, and like, there are a couple teams towards the top that we don't have a lot of trust in. The idea that, like, I use the phrase defining success a lot. And for Dallas, I think there's a distinct chance that they win a round in the playoffs this year. And for a team that is 16th in net rating right now, though there is injury context and a few that matters here, that's actually kind of high praise when you consider how strong numerically the top of the West is. But does winning one round and losing in the second and having that kind of be maybe like, that's the kind of level of team that I think Dallas is setting up for the next couple of years. Is that enough to satisfy their like Luka and the other players who matter here? It could be, but historically it hasn't been.
Yeah, I mean, I am not sanguine.
Yeah.
They're
doing a lot of things that poorly run teams do.
I mean, and I think this gets to it, is that each trade, each move they make is like, okay, that makes sense except for detail XYZ. And then the next move they make is like, so to address that detail, and then it's sort of like they're, you know, it's very much like, you know, a fingers in the dike situation where like they plug up one hole and open up another, but hey, we're compromised in different ways, and it's in sort of service of what, as an end product.
Okay, well, I know your time is very valuable. I will thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And I guess the one thing you're saying that the West is murky. I don't think the West is that murky, if we're honest.
What it is that there aren't that many teams at the top that I totally trust, either for health reasons or for.
We trust the Nuggets and Clippers and are intrigued by the Thunder, and the Wolves are good, but we don't trust them in the playoffs because of you know, both their roster and who some of their key players are, and everyone else. I mean, maybe this is being dismissive of the Suns, but everyone else kind of doesn't matter.
It will take a lot for them to matter.
Yeah.
And like play and development. And especially, it's very different to do this evaluation 50 games in than to do it preseason. We've gotten a lot more, even with the Suns, where Bradley Beal missed a whole bunch of the season. I mean, if a team is going to blow me away, they probably have done it by now.
No, and I think we've talked about, you know, it being murky all season. But if you step back and look, like, there are three teams we trust in the league right now, and, you know, level of trust aside from Denver in the Clippers and Celtics is understandably, like, you know, with an asterisk, but, you know, like, that's the bar. Like, can you reach that level in the postseason? If no, then, you know, then what are we doing? And some of the other teams, like, clearly have that level of play in them. It's just we're skeptical for various reasons, whether it's health, whether it's sort of offense defense balance, whether it's coaching, that any of like sort of five other teams,
or in Philadelphia's case, every single one. Oh no, I was gonna say in Philly's case, every one of them, but Doc Rivers isn't their coach anymore.
Yeah.
But they have a lot of questions.
And again, would you, like, right now, would you, given their roster and, you know, what has been pretty good coaching actually for the last, you know, for this year,
I think Nurse has done a very good job with them.
No, but I was going to say, like, if you're going to say, like, what the, like, if there was a fourth team you would shoe in there, like the Knicks have a shout at being that fourth team, which is, you know, it's weird, but the amount that they've upgraded their roster and not given a lot away and shown themselves to be resilient to some injuries, and I think have the Robinson injury almost like revealed, like, I think Hartenstein is just a better player right now than Mitchell Robinson, and I think that's sort of revealed some of the best ways for them going forward, and then they add depth and shooting, and so and here we are, bing bong.
Bing bong, bing bong indeed. Well, thank you, my friend, for taking the time.
Thanks a lot, Danny.
Thanks again to Seth Partno for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic, and you can also read his Nerd Noshes at Dunked On Prime, which is a really fun thing that we have included. He goes on a lot of different directions, and I truly do love reading them. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode. That is great, whatever podcast player you use. And if Real GM Radio is not in a podcast player that you want it to be, let me know and I will pass it along, and hopefully we can make that happen. And we've done that over the years a number of different places. And you can also help other people find the show. That is through leaving a rating and review, word of mouth, social media, however you want to do it. And then the single most important thing you can do for this podcast and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors for this episode. That is FanDuel. FanDuel.com/Boston. New customers get $200 in bonus bets if your first bet of $5 or more wins, which is a very cool promotion that they're doing right now. You can also check out my other work, Dunked On and Dunked On Prime, which of course includes some of Seth's excellent work that's going strong. We do salary sheets and everything else, and there's lots of great stuff there. Nate and I are taking it a little bit lighter for the week after the deadline for the All-Star break, because it's one of the few breaks that we truly get during the season, but still lots of great content available there. Also, written work at The Athletic. I have a piece coming out on Saturday about where things stand for the 24 offseason. So you can check that out. And then I wrote before the deadline on a couple of different topics. You can check that. Of course, excellent work from a lot of other wonderful people, some of whom are on Real GM Radio at times as well. And then the NBA strategy stream will be back after the break. We will be back, I think it's Monday, February 22nd or something in that range. We're still working on our schedule, because as things shifted around due to the trade deadline and injuries, we're working through that. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I don't always get back to people. I'm not, admittedly, not the greatest on that. But reading it, that's why I consider it feedback, it is very important to me. So that is all for now. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.